following presentation is a Bernacki and Krause production.
Let me see. Give me the number 4, the pollo, por favor. That's the go.
Yes, sir.
The city of Albuquerque, in the heart of New Mexico and the land of enchantment, lies a community home to a cinematic universe that's full of drama and suspense. In recent years, the once peaceful community has seen a surge in illegal activity, thanks to the work of a shady lawyer in the making.
A chemistry teacher with a newfound identity.
And the heart of a cartel seeping through the underbelly of the city.
It is in this community where we have come to watch the character study of Better Call Saul unfold.
With the gift to gab and a smile you can't forget,
the evolution of James McGill to the beloved persona of Saul Goodman, attorney at law, has captured the interest of millions of fans across the world, making us hold our breath in suspense over the course of this perilous path. This is the story of not just one, but several characters, each on their own morally compelling journey.
This character study is just one of the reasons we enjoy the cinematic world Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould have created, and we hope you do too. I'm Joseph Bernacki.
And I'm Alex Krause.
And this is The Truth Is How You Look At It, a Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad podcast.
God damn it!
I'm using that as a sound clip now if I can pick up Nick's voice. Anyway, good evening, everyone, and welcome to another installment of The Truth Is How You Look At It, episode 14. We are back recording from Winnipeg, Manitoba. I'm your host, Joseph Bernacki, along with my co-host,
Alexander Krause. Always a pleasure to be here. It's been far too long, guys. We're happy to be back.
We are very happy to be back. That is an understatement. We've had a very busy summer, both working on the job, and we figured, hey, it's time to bring back our podcast. We know we left things off in season 2, and we appreciate your support through the first 13 weeks that we started earlier in 2021. We're going to be bringing you the rest of season 2 coming up in the next few weeks here, and we're really happy to be back. And I mean, to tell you, to jump back into the swing of things here, we've got a great episode on tap, probably one of the best from season 2. Today's episode is Gloves Off. You'll understand the title reference pretty shortly, but just some quick background info before we get into things here. The episode debuted March 7th, 2016, 5 years ago, you know, already, and time is going by fast as they are working on season 6.
Feels like a lifetime at this point.
The episode was directed by Adam Bernstein and written by Gordon Smith. And then, of course, something to note from the two of them, from both Adam and Gordon, it was these two gentlemen that directed and wrote 5-0 from Better Call Saul's first season. In our opinion, I think Alex and I both agree it's one of the best episodes of the series, with its focus on developing Mike's backstory and history in Philadelphia before moving to Albuquerque. It's an interesting choice that these two are working together again in the second season. I don't know if you picked up on that, Alex, but I think you'll see, you know, this episode was so heavily focused on Mike. It picks up on some things that they used in the first season.
For sure. I'm glad that they used the same crew in this involvement of this episode, because that 5-0 was one of the first episodes we got to see the show shift away from Jimmy onto Mike. And here we get to see it expand into some more characters, actually, very shortly.
And, you know, in terms of the Better Call Saul universe right now, I know we all had a bit of a scare a few weeks ago. We were all sending our thoughts and prayers out to Bob Odenkirk and his family. I know us from Winnipeg, you know, we have a huge base of support here. He made Nobody here, which did really well in the box office. Go check out that movie if you haven't seen it before. So we're glad that he's doing okay after suffering a small heart attack, you know, and hoping things can continue with production soon on season 6. From my understanding, I think they're through 7 episodes of production, so they still got about half a season to do, as they are anticipating an early 2022 release, which I'm sure everyone would like to see. It's been a long time since things wrapped up in April 2020.
Yeah. Couldn't be avoided, right? A lot of shows have been pushed back.
Yeah. So going into the first scene here, there's not a whole lot to discuss, but it is an interesting cold opening. Like many in the Better Call Saul series, we are left with a mystery as to why certain things happen and why they are purposefully chosen first in the sequence of scenes by the director and the writers. In this short first scene, we get a glimpse into Mike's house, which we don't often get to see, and we see Mike first drop an envelope of some hefty cash on his kitchen table. He then proceeds to go to his fridge, where he grabs a Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, cracks it open, and then grabs a large bag of frozen carrots from the freezer. All this time, we are meant to only see half of Mike's face based on the camera placement. Pretty clever. Almost like Two-Face from the Batman's Dark Knight. Kind of think of her just from the Batman series. As Mike sits down, he removes the bag from his face, and we see he has been severely beaten by someone. He has one of the worst black eyes I've ever seen. It's basically swollen shut. He can't really open it. His nose and lip are cut, and he ain't doing too hot. He looks down at his hands, and he's holding a boxing glove charm that could be made out of gold. Not sure, but it looks pretty nice. And the intro fades to black as the audience is left wondering what the hell has happened to Mike.
Yeah, sort of anticipate something happened, right? And then we'll get to find out shortly.
Yeah, based on the choice and the sequence of events, we'll wait to discuss the opening, as Alex said. But what's important to note in that, where we left things off in the previous episode, Amarillo, the final scene has Mike and Nacho meeting at an eerie abandoned building to discuss a problem that Nacho has. Nacho says he needs a guy taken care of, and Mike's interest level is peaked. Is there a correlation between this and that? Most likely yes, if you haven't seen the show before. And now Alex will take things into our first full scene, but our second scene in the show.
Yeah, for sure. And the second scene opens with Miss Strauss on the television as Jimmy's commercial plays in front of Cliff and two other partners gathered in a room alongside Jimmy. As the commercial finishes, they take turns demanding answers and listening to Jimmy's responses. Jimmy explains the whole thing only costed South of like $700, which seems to aggravate Cliff even more. You think this whole thing's about money? Cliff seems to ream out Jimmy at every point. Jimmy then points out like the success of the entire commercial and how it continues to be. You think, hell, the phones are still ringing off from this one experiment. Even as they're talking, the phones are ringing, right? But Jimmy doesn't see the issue at hand, and one of the partners literally has to explain it to him. Jimmy cut them out of the process entirely when he made that commercial. The worst part is, Jimmy then turns it back onto Cliff, coming up to him and reminding him that he gave Jimmy express permission and authority over client outreach. Jimmy, if I put you in charge of payroll, would that mean I'd be okay with you handing out $1 million bonuses? Like, Cliff has a point here, right? The partners are dismayed at this point, and they operate as a team around here. And if Jimmy continues to act as a sole practitioner, perhaps this isn't going to work. Jimmy quickly advocates for himself. He's here to help the case and everyone else, but brutally, Cliff lets him know there was a vote to have him fired with cause. 2-1, they wanted him gone, but Cliff here believes in second chances. Strike 1 and 2, anything else, he's out of here. Jimmy's pretty devastated, sternly walking back to his office. He gets some looks of sympathy from the staff, and to me it really feels like they feel bad for him here. Naturally, as soon as he's back in the office, the first person he calls is Kim. Reaching her voicemail, he tries to get her on call ASAP, but we cut to her phone in a box outside the boardroom in HHM. It's too late, she's already in a meeting with Chuck and Howard discussing this issue. They're reaming her out for knowing about the commercial and not warning them. They're caught off guard by co-counsel's commercial, and this reflects poorly on them and Kim. She's given leave and departs, with Chuck and Howard alone, Chuck wanting to know what will be done, pressuring Howard into doing something, right? We cut over to Mike and Nacho standing across from El Machicano?
Yeah, Machicano restaurant.
Yeah. We cut over to Mike and Nacho standing across from El Machicano restaurant, opposite side of the road. Nacho is discussing why the location's ideal, how he can get an angle from here onto the store, how it's Nacho's and Tuco's spot for dealing with money, and how Tuco faces outwards as he sits in the place. Nacho goes into detail about Tuco's habits, such as a lie detector that he has, how he looks people in the eye for up to 10 minutes at a time, just staring into their soul, sort of trying to intimidate them. He explains the entire process of how Tuco and him get money at this location every Tuesday. And to Mike, he wants him to cap Tuco as he's leaving. Super easy, says Nacho. Yeah, no. Mike doesn't take anything at face value. He points out all the flaws in the plans as fast as Nacho can come up with them. Nacho says, like, just take the I-40 on the ramp 8 blocks up. You're in the wind before anyone has time to blink. And here's the beauty. All the dealers know we're here. Could be any one of them wanting a part of Tuco's cut as far as the cartel is concerned.
Yeah.
But Mike says, well, it's full day, lights, plenty of traffic. How does he not be seen, least of all in his car, right? Murphy's Law tells him someone's going to pull a plate. Fine, just go to the yard, get a beater, drive by and pop him. Nobody's going to see you. And if anybody does, you're nobody. You don't have a connection. You're a ghost.
Yeah.
But Mike, I love this line here. He says, what if somebody comes in behind me? I'm blocked. There goes the exit, right? Who's going to pull in behind you? Well, I'm guessing someone who likes tacos. But Nacho, he really wants this done. He's like, Mike, you can figure this, all the details out yourself, but this hit needs to happen. And Mike tries to scale it back and ask him, is this what you really want? Taking out your partner? As connected to 5-0, we know it's a big deal, right?
Yeah.
So Nacho then goes in to explain the reason why he wants Tuco taken out.
Taco, yeah.
Taco taken out.
It's all good. I'd probably say the same thing.
Yeah. But he goes on to tell a story about Tuco's favorite supplier in the biker gangs and how he used to use crank that he was applied with. And one day when he was doing his lie detector, his favorite guy, Dog, was like, confused. He was like, what the hell? He's like this guy before, normal interactions. All of a sudden, Tuco, calm as anything else, blows the guy's head off of the sawn-off while Nacho's standing right behind him. And Nacho gets a piece of his skull embedded into him as a scar. Tuco's now using Crystal, which has a far stronger kick, and Nacho doesn't want anything to do with Tuco if he finds about his independent ventures, right? Mike understands the situation, but doesn't seem too happy. He finally chimes in with his input, Nacho asking him the whole time. There's a sniping position behind him, and anyone could take a shot from there and be out of there before anyone notices.
Yeah.
He'll consider it for 50 grand, and we end the scene there.
It's a solid scene. It's a long scene.
It is a very, very long scene.
Probably just in part because not much happens in the intro, and it's rather short. There's a lot of takeaways there. Alex brought up some really good points about the last part of it. But, you know, Alex, as your background in the legal world, without getting into details of your own personal experience, but what you and I have talked about this before, this whole idea of Jimmy versus the firm itself. When Jimmy was first shooting this commercial, we both thought, you know, Jimmy did a great job putting out, I think, a very effective advertisement. Much better than something that you'd see if you or a loved one have suffered from mesothelioma, you may be entitled to a cash settlement. But you would talk to me a lot about stepping over your boundary. You know, I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on how much in the wrong is Jimmy here and is standing with the firm.
100%. The first time I watched this episode, and I think the creators did an excellent job on portraying both sides, but mainly taking the point of view from Jimmy here. I was mainly of the concern, like, the commercial worked. What's the issue here? I had Jimmy's perspective.
Yeah.
But more experience in the field, I can definitely tell you, oh my God, like, that's such an egregious overstep. Like, just imagine one of your subordinates making an entire decision upon business. Like, imagine if they made a commercial underneath you representing everything and it went horribly wrong. And I think there's some great points brought up by the partners and Cliff here, how they talk about this commercial goes far beyond anything and just the case. It represents the entire firm. It represents other cases. This one case does not put food on the table for them forever. They have a business which goes far beyond that. If clients from other places saw this commercial and it was offensive in some way, then they could affect their business in a variety of different ways. And the main point is that they cut them out of the process. it's a voting when it comes to a partnership, and different partners have different stakes in the firm. And for a new partner, just newly hired like he is, to make a decision upon everyone's behalf, that's such an overstep of authority for sure.
And, you know, branching off of it, and we'll talk about it a little bit later in the episode, but now Kim's standing in on this problem. Her scene with Chuck and Howard, she's in a pretty tough situation here. Has she really done anything wrong as of this point?
No, it doesn't seem so. It will tie into the explanation a bit further scenes. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but to me at this point, no.
And Nacho's plan, as Alex was describing in detail, what do you think of it? I mean, it's kind of weird because obviously for all of those who have seen Breaking Bad, we know that at this point, Tuco is not going to be removed.
Mm.
But it still begs the question, you know, was this a bad plan? I thought Nacho's plan was pretty good. Even like I questioned some of Mike's, it's not paranoia, but it's just his thinking everything through. Is there going to be a car that's going to pull in behind Mike? Highly doubtful. We see that that restaurant's not like it's like a McDonald's or a KFC or everyone's just piling through to get food. But I don't know. Like I think Nacho has thought a lot of things through, even suggesting go get a beater, you know, pop up beside him, drive by, boom. But Mike's not on board with it. And I don't know. It just seems like maybe the writers kind of back themselves into a little bit of a corner. It's like where we have to tell this story. On, okay, well, we can't kill him this episode, but what's going to be the lead up to that? I don't know. If you have any more thoughts on what Nacho said.
I have a counterpoint. If anything, it says as to the experience of Mike. You bring up these points of, sure. Okay, what are the chances of someone coming up behind him and such? But surely this man, as we can see throughout the entire series, he's highly experienced in everything he does.
Yeah.
If we remember in 5-0, he manages to trick the cops into believing that he's fully drunk and that he has no weapon on him.
Yeah.
He knows what he's doing at all points. And it was clearly planned out perfectly. I feel like Mike's the type of person that doesn't take chances. And that's speaking of his character. If he knows that someone could potentially take his plate, he's not going to take that risk. If he knows someone could potentially come up behind him and cut off his only chance of escape, he's never going to take that risk.
It has to be resolute.
Yeah. So, of course, he goes for the best option, which may be the sniping position here. Does that tie into the fact that we know Tuco may survive later on? Yes, but I think there's a legitimate reason here. It does speak to Mike's experience.
Also worth noting, this is the first appearance of the El Machicano restaurant in Better Call Saul. At least we don't really see it in Breaking Bad, but we're going to see it a lot going forward on Better Call Saul as one of the cartel's restaurants, or I guess legitimate businesses, but you know they use it as a meeting place to deal drugs and collect cash.
Suffice it to say, there's not a lot of love for you in the room at the moment. The vote is currently 2-1 to fire you for cause. However, I believe in second chances. But know this is both strike one and strike two. Going forward, you can expect a great deal more scrutiny.
What are you going to do?
Full daylight, plenty of traffic. How exactly do I not get seen? My car, at least. Murphy's Law tells me somebody's going to pull a plate.
Go to the yard, buy a beater. You got to stay in the car. Ain't no one gonna see you, and if they do see you, so what? That's why you're perfect. You're no one, you got no connections. You're a ghost.
So I pull in next to him. That assumes there's a parking spot.
Our guys park next to him. They come and go from the same spot. Last one takes off, and you're open.
Someone comes in behind me, I'm blocked.
Who's gonna pull in behind you?
Well, I'm guessing someone who likes tacos. What then? What's my exit?
Get out and run.
Bad knees.
Look, the details, that's what I'm paying you for. If you got a better plan, go on, tell me. I'm all ears.
You sure about this? Killing your partner. That's a bell you don't unring.
Anyway, we're going to pick things up now in the third scene. And things have left off, you know, as we see Jimmy trying to enter HH&M. He looks for Kim and finds she is not in her second floor office, and he starts to worry. The cleaning staff tells him that she's in the basement. When Jimmy heads down to the office, it's kind of like it's almost dungeon-like, and finds Kim sitting alone by herself in a long corridor, like kind of boardroom, but it's just full of documents, and the room is basically doc review. So what's happened really is, as punishment for not letting the firm know about Jimmy's commercial, Kim has been demoted at the firm, but not fired. Kim is not happy to see Jimmy and tells him not talk to Howard or their relationship is done. Jimmy's kind of perplexed himself, and he thought maybe they were done, but he says we're not, you know, and Kim just kind of looks back at him like, now's not the time for this kind of, you know, talk, whatever. And Jimmy tries to argue that, you know, the commercial was a success, but acknowledges, okay, maybe I did screw up. But he is insistent on, I think, trying to get Kim out of this bad situation. He leaves her alone to go to Chuck's house to go talk to his brother, who, as things ended in the first season, and then in the beginning of season two, Jimmy and Chuck have not talked a whole lot, so things could get interesting on this front. So he gets to his brother's house, and he enters through the back door of the house, isn't getting a response from Chuck, and finds his older brother distraught and curled up, like lying down on the couch in a multi-layer space blanket of tinfoil. He can't get much of an answer out of Chuck to say anything, and just Chuck asks him for a glass of water, and then he brings it back to him, and he proceeds to turn off the lantern, and he sits in the dark while his brother is dealing with another setback of his alleged condition. I say alleged because Alex and I and many Better Call Saul fans have debated whether or not really Chuck is physically sick or, you know, sick of the mind. Meanwhile, for Mike, this is where things get really interesting. A lot of cameos today to discuss. We receive a great cameo on the part of the gun salesman that Walter White strikes a deal with in the fourth season of Breaking Bad. In the second episode of the fourth season called 38 Snub, Walt looks for a weapon to protect himself after Gus has horrifically killed one of his men in front of Walt and Jesse in the previous episode. Spoiler alert, but again, I think a lot of you have seen Breaking Bad. If not, please go check out that series. We'll be talking about it as well. In that episode, Walt meets this gun salesman that Mike meets with now and looks at options of a 38, I guess, revolver. In this episode, Mike is offered a choice of three long-range weapons that could work to use on Tuco in their plan executed by Nacho. Well, Mike. Mike looks over an AR-50, an SR-25 match rifle, and the classic M-40 with the gun dealer. All serious weapons of destruction here. And Mike turns down each weapon for a variety of reasons. One gun is a hernia on his back, like 34 pounds. The SR-25 could jam. And the other, the M40, he's used before, and he talks about in reference to Vietnam, I believe. They make a joke about the war.
Yeah, so this weapon was changed. It used flexiglass, if I believe, instead of wood.
Yeah.
To me, it's sort of referencing perhaps the even more experience that Mike has. I don't know if he himself was in Vietnam.
Yeah.
They never do touch upon it.
I don't think so.
In that regard, but.
Yeah, but he turns down the M40, but I think if he were to choose one, he would have went with that one. But anyway, Mike offers to pay the dealer regardless of not buying a gun, and he thanks him for his time. The dealer says his services are available anytime, and there definitely is a mutual respect between the two men, as there was between the dealer and Walt. And the scene wraps up with us left wondering how Mike is going to carry out this plan. So Alex, before we talk about that last cameo there, Jimmy's actions reflecting on Kim. That's a tough, like, I feel horrible for Kim getting thrown under the bus. Was just a joke, I thought, in all of this. I mean, later on, Jimmy's going to talk about with his brother what Kim really knew, but, like, I just feel horrible for her.
Yeah, my first impressions were it's completely unwarranted in all regards. There's nothing that would warrant just a conversation then punishing her in such a drastic measures. it's ridiculous, right? Especially off work time. But as we get into the later scenes, there are some things worth considering that they bring up. So we'll touch that in a moment. Do have some other questions here. Jimmy seemed to want in confrontation when he was barged into Chuck's house. And what do you think of him resorting back to his helpful brother, like looking after his brother type instincts?
I was going to ask you, before Jimmy goes to help his brother, do you think Chuck's condition here is a ploy? Do you think Chuck is, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but do you think Chuck probably knew that his brother was going to come and talk with him about all of this that's just happened? Do you think Chuck purposely puts himself in a state, or he's at least pretending to be, in order to not have to deal with Jimmy right now, and he can deal with Jimmy later?
Personally, no. I think more it's related to the fact, and this is what I love about Better Call Saul, so much interpretation here back and forth. I personally think that it's related to the fact that he knows that he's acts like slipping Jimmy here a little bit. He tells lies to Kim, and then he goes on to do something without other people's authority. And hearing upon Jimmy acting that way, it sort of subconsciously brings up his condition, right? And we've seen throughout the show previously, and perhaps will in future.
So, what do I think about Jimmy helping out his brother? It's the second time going around watching the series, it makes me think, boy, Jimmy's quick to turn back on everything he had felt, all of, you know, the vitriol, you know, like the hatred that he had for his brother in the second last episode of season one. And all of a sudden, he's getting him a water or whatever, he's comforting him. It's a little shocking, I guess. You know, you'd figure, okay, Jimmy's not going to get an answer out of him, he leaves. Or maybe he just sits there, maybe, and just doesn't, and waits it out. But
I think it's why Jimmy's such a sympathetic and great character that most of the audience can correlate with. It's he helps his brother when he's in need. Despite everything that they had before the argument, he still goes to his aid. But we'll see where that leads in scene four here.
Before we get to that, though, I do want to discuss the Breaking Bad cameo. What were your thoughts on that part of the scene and just Mike's decision to not take one of the guns? I really think Mike should have took the last gun.
I think it ties into what I was saying before about the fact that if there's a chance of something going wrong, Mike wouldn't take it, right? As we see with the hernia weapon, the A-50.
Yeah, the AR-50. Yeah. That's a good gun, too.
It is, but if it's cumbersome, then he knows not to use it. He'd much rather something versatile, flexible, and bad position, right? And he knows his weapons. If there's a chance of it jamming, he wouldn't take it. And I think that ties into the fact that he does his research, as we've seen with his previous gigs, right? He knows what he's stepping into beforehand. So I really like that. And it's nice to see cameos, as we'll continue to see throughout the show, right?
Even if they're just small, minute parts, for them to call back the same actor or actress,
Yeah, because it shows that continuity of universe here.
That's the Armalite AR-50. State of the art. Accurate to 2,400 meters. I've got the Leupold Mark IV on it now, but I can always upgrade it to a Schmidt and Bender. Single shot, bolt, simple. Effective, reliable. It fires the 50 caliber BMG. Very effective against soft targets in light cover, behind cars, small diameter trees and such. As always, I've gone to the trouble of grinding down the serial number.
Now, unless you ground a hole clean through, acid will recover it.
Well, that would be true, but I follow up with a pass through a random stipple machine press. Hides the patterns in the metal density. Should throw off your X-ray diffraction and some other higher-end methods. Nothing's perfect, of course, but this is close.
Looks like a hernia with a scope on it.
34 pounds. not including your bipod, which adds some heft.
Too much gun.
For most applications, I would tend to agree. Which brings us to the M40. Tried and true, battle tested. Essentially the same rifle used by Marine snipers since 1966. It's light, accurate, good for soft targets in the 8 to 1200 meter range. You seem to know this one.
Oh, yeah. You could say that. Wood warped like hell. You get it wet, you put it in the sun, gone. Somebody probably should have figured that out before they sent it into a damn jungle.
Yeah, probably.
I've changed my mind. Thank you. I don't need anything at this time. For your trouble?
It's no trouble. I make my living on repeat business. When you need what I'm offering, you know how to find me.
Sorry, we'll move on to the fourth scene here. As Chuck comes to in the midst of his space blankets, as Jimmy is sitting across from him, they break the ice by asking each other how they slept. Chuck stating he could use some tea. Once he starts sipping on some tea that Jimmy makes for him, this space blanket comes off, though he still has his suit jacket on, right? Jimmy's sitting to the side and lets him know that he was scared of Chuck when he found him last night, of his condition that he was in. It was more than ready to take him to the hospital. And I think in part, it ties into the fact that he's enabling, like that, like the doctor in the first season said.
Who's enabling?
Jimmy is enabling Chuck in not taking him to the hospital by giving him another space blanket here. Chuck says that he stays far too long in the office and it's having an effect on him. Overdoes it, as if it's a normal thing that's acceptable to wear space blankets.
And Jimmy says, boy, you were really working hard at the office, you know.
Yeah.
Sticking it
To poor Kim here, which they go on to speak about. Chuck is insistent that it's not his decision, but he was present at her meeting. It's rather Jimmy's fault. In fact, it was Howard's decision to punish her, all relating back to Jimmy's actions. All personnel staff are under the discretion of Howard, as if he's not some puppet to Chuck, which Jimmy quickly brings up, right? Kim was the one who recommended Jimmy to Davis and Maine, and their recommendation reflects poorly on HHM when Jimmy misconducts himself. And I think that's a really important fact.
That's true.
Yeah. Reflects poorly on their reputation, right? She should have been looking out for the firm's interests, but Jimmy reveals that she didn't know anything. As far as she was concerned, Cliff knew of the commercial. Of course, Chuck's reaction was like, ugh, he just knew something like that was to happen. She didn't state anything because she didn't know anything, and she didn't want Jimmy to look bad when she found out. She knows you. She should have known better, Chuck states. Ugh, you're such an asshole, says Jimmy. Why? For pointing out the fact that her one mistake was believing in you? Oh, Chuck always knows how to hit Jimmy hard, I swear. Jimmy reminds him it was one commercial. It was no big deal. And hell, it worked like a dream, right? And from the first time I watched this episode, I was thinking the same way. But watching again, I definitely changed my mind here. Chuck immediately hits the nail on the head, stating, Jimmy's problem is he thinks the end justifies the means here. Jimmy still doesn't get what he did was wrong. Chuck rants on about how he hurt everyone along the way, from Kim and Howard vouching for him, to Cliff and partners for being made fools by a subordinate. Chuck is mystified why he hasn't been fired yet. And Jimmy's had enough. Well, what will it take to get Kim back here? He's trying to argue. We'll do whatever it takes. But Chuck's like, it's not one big game. Life's not one big game. But as we see here, differing opinions here. Jimmy's like, it is. I'm Monty Hall. What's behind door number two? What will it take, huh? Want to stop me from being a lawyer? For a second, Chuck is about to say something. I think that's kind of important, but...
Doesn't Jimmy have a line where it's like, dig down, reach down in the dirt with me, or whatever, roll around.
But he starts to walk away. But Jimmy does not let this go. He is super persistent. He wants to make this deal. But Chuck is not going to commit extortion. Why not? Jimmy says, his eyes lighting up while Chuck looks demoralized over at him. Come roll around in the dirt with me. Yeah. All your dreams will come true. Chuck is pissed at this point. Whatever happens with Jimmy being a lawyer is between him and the Bar Association and his job. He does not want to be a hypocrite and get involved. Clearly, he doesn't need any help from Chuck, apparently, to tank his career. Speaking of which, it's a long drive to Santa Fe.
Last line that Michael McKean delivers.
After all the help that Jimmy gave him, then delivers that as if the help that he gave him was part of the reason why he's at fault. It's like, oof. As Jimmy leaves to try and drive as fast as he can back, Chuck looks a little bad in condition, right, as he's leaving. I think that was one of the best confrontations between the two, as we'll get to see some more for sure, and we've seen previously, but whenever those two are on scene, it's such chemistry between the two actors. We cut over to Nacho meeting up with Mike, and Mike is determined he won't do the hit. He argues that a dead Salamanca will only draw more attention to Nacho's business.
The cartel.
Yeah. Nacho doesn't want to hear it and says this problem will get addressed one way or another. Mike gives him a proposition instead, saying Tuco will be going away without anyone being killed. But before he can explain any further, it cuts to the end of the scene.
The ending is really interesting of that scene because it's like, even I'm just thinking about it now, with Mike even using the words cartel, up until this point on Better Call Saul, it's probably the first mention of there being the cartel.
It's a good point.
You know, like Jimmy, yeah, he gets thrown out in the desert with them by mistake, by accident in the first season, off the skateboard con that goes wrong, and we see that Nacho's around and all that, but even the deals for pills with Price, that's not really getting into the heart of like Breaking Bad or stuff. This is probably one of the first real episodes where we get into some major like implications of what could happen down the line in the other series.
100%. Yeah. I think it's one of the first times that they explicitly stated the cartel, right? They always allied to it a little bit earlier with Nacho doing his side business against his boss's knowledge. And so forth, like the other instances you described, but mm-hmm. here it's definitely coming more into the fold. They're slowly pulling in that string.
Do you have any other takeaways from Jimmy? Well, it's almost like Jimmy versus Chuck Part 2. Mm-hmm. I've labeled it almost as from the second last episode of season 1 where they have their falling out. Just, I could ask you who's in the right, but it's just...
It's hard. I think... The more I watch it, the more gray there is. And I think that just goes to show what such a great show it is.
Do you really think deep down Chuck wants Jimmy to quit?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
The moment that he went to say something, you could tell that, yeah, he wanted Jimmy gone because he knew all those things that Jimmy was saying was true, that he felt like Jimmy was a chimp with a machine gun, yeah. right? With a law degree. He even talks about... the analogy with the bus, he's handed the keys and a whole bunch of other instances. He thinks Jimmy's walking a dangerous line when practicing the law, and he's only ever going to hurt more people.
I guess the real question is, and we don't really get to learn from this episode today, but was it really Howard's decision or Chuck's decision to... I think this is more on Howard, actually. I don't think this was Chuck. Like, you could read into it and you think, well, just to get under Jimmy's skin, I'm going to tell Howard to... I don't know. I still feel like this particular instance is on Howard, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
I always think Chuck always has a effect on Howard, right? He's Chuck is the model for Howard. He's always looked up to him, Howard.
Yeah.
But
Howard's always
looked up to Chuck. Sorry, I looked up. Yeah, apologies.
Yeah, no.
And I think when he states, well, what are you going to do about it? It sort of just pushes him. It's a very subtle thing, but
it is very subtle.
That's how Chuck operates at times. And I think there's so much to take away from this conversation. Oof, like Chuck always always takes the opportunity to hurt Jimmy wherever he can. Even if he is in the right in some regards, just because you're right, the way you go about it doesn't make it so, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Chuck, deliberately acts in such a manner, as we can see in the last line especially, but especially so when he says, she knows you, she should have known better. Like, oof.
Oh, yeah. And I guess my only other thought is, again, you mentioned it when you were talking about the second scene, but Nacho's really starting to show some impatience here with the Tuco problem.
And he wants it sorted, and I think his reasoning's pretty legitimate. Like, he doesn't know when he's going to be popped next, right? Yeah. And we'll see what that side business is related to, but he's clearly afraid of the same fate as Dog, the biker, which was shot.
What I was trying to say basically is we don't see the scene, but it's just one of those things with, you know, all the different things that Tuco's done over Breaking Bad. You could almost see it in a flashback, like Nacho getting capped by a shotgun fragment. Be pretty horrific.
Yeah, you can envision something that visceral happening, right?
But yeah.
Just like Tuco's character, do you do something from 0 to 100, calm to blowing some guy's head off?
Guess it's hard not to stay. There's so many important things for you to do there. Like, you know, stick it to Kim Wexler.
What did I do to Kim Wexler?
She's back in the cornfield, isn't she?
I didn't do anything to Kim. I mean, I was present, yes. But management of personnel, those decisions are all Howard's.
That is rich. But tell me, when Howard was making his management decisions, was he sitting on your knee with your arm up his ass? Hey, can he talk? Will you drink a glass of water?
That's uncalled for. See, that's your problem, Jimmy. Thinking the ends justify the means. And you're forever shocked when it all blows up in your face.
What did I do that was so wrong?
You broke the rules. You turned Kim into your accessory. You embarrassed Howard, who, God help him, inexplicably vouched for you with Cliff Maine. You made Cliff and his partners look like schmucks. Shall I go on? Now someone's given you the keys to the school bus, and I'm not going to let you drive it off a cliff.
Can we just get down to brass tacks here? What can I do to put Kim back where she belongs, huh? Wait, you want me to quit Davis and Maine? That's fine. I never wanted that job in the first place.
I can't get through to you. Life is not one big game of let's make a deal.
Yes, it is. I'm Monty Hall. What's behind door number two? What'll it take, huh?
Because if I were impeding the career of one of my employees for the purpose of compelling you to do something against your will, that would be extortion.
Yeah, it would. So, you gonna extort me, Chuck? You just set things right for Kim. You get her back in her office, out of doc review, everything back to normal, and I quit the law for good. No more Jimmy McGill Esquire. Poof, like he never even existed. Wow.
It's not Tuco. It's keeping a secret. A dead Tuco draws Salamancas like flies. Cartel noses into the business, looks for who hit one of theirs. You gonna be able to keep your secrets then?
With you, without you, I don't care. But something's gonna happen.
You said it yourself. You don't need him dead. You need him to go away.
You mean snitch? Man, I drop a dime on Tuco, who do you think the cartel looks at? Me. And if I call the cops, I get picked up too. I'm what you call a known associate. So I'm locked up with Tuco, who's looking for the guy that put him there. Tell me how that helps me.
You won't have to talk to the cops. You won't have to do any time. There's no killing but your Tuco problem. It goes away.
Going into the final scene to today's episode, we start again outside the Machicano restaurant to find another interesting and important Breaking Bad cameo. I have to look this one up to double check. In Crazy 8, or as he is referred to on Better Call Saul, he's Domingo. Sunday for all you Spanish-speaking folks out there. Anyway, he's wearing his Tampico furniture store attire. Little interesting tidbit. He talks to Walter White about that on Breaking Bad. So we see that that is in fact his day job. But on the side, he is a dealer for Tuco and Nacho. We get another great cameo reprisal by Raymond Cruz portraying Tuco Salamanca. We finally see him again after the first season. And he's counting the money and staring directly into the soul of Domingo. He's kind of like flipping through the bills like they're a deck of playing cards or something. And he says, oh, it's all there, you know. And Nacho kind of has to like get Tuco to acknowledge that, you know, Domingo's not pulling a fast one on them or whatever. And he's like, Tuco doesn't really say anything. And, you know, Nacho gets the scene moving forward. And Domingo thanks the two, you know, I'll see you next week, Tuco. Yeah, later, Domingo or whatever. And Nacho talks to him. And meanwhile, as all this is going on, Mike is on a payphone calling into the Albuquerque police, disguising himself, I love this part, as an anonymous witness or passerby to a beating taking place at the El Mexicano restaurant. He doesn't want to reveal his name, as he tells the police, I don't want to get involved.
Because he sees a gun. It might be a gang thing.
Yeah. So, a moment later, this is where things really start to escalate. Mike pulls in his classic car, and he purposely bumps into Tuco's hot rod out front. To which Tuco looks up like a straight, like a dog, and whenever he is like, he quickly catches notice. Mike enters the restaurant and walks past the two men, and Tuco's like, hey! And Mike walks up to the old Spanish chef behind the counter, and he orders my favorite. Yeah, let me get the number for the pollo, por favor. You know, he orders the chicken taco, I guess, and talks to the clerk cooking in the back. And this poor guy, he's just like cooking in the back while these drug cartel guys are in the front. We don't know who that guy, the cook, is, but anyway. Tuco confronts Mike, and he's like, you know, excuse me, old man, you know, you just hit my car. And he's like, oh, me, fellas? Check out Mr. Magoo over here. And I love the scene. There's so many good quotes. Tuco has that classic raspy laugh of his that's hard to imitate. But, Mike's playing dumb here, and he's pretending to be aware of not hitting the car. And Tuco says, you see the one that you parked your piece of shit next to? The scene escalates basically as Mike wants to leave the restaurant, but he's also making sure to instigate Tuco enough to get his full attention. So Mike walks outside, and Tuco's like, you're not leaving out of here. You know, you're not getting out of here without paying up, basically. And he demands Mike give up his wallet to walk away alive, you know, without getting unscathed. And Mike says, you know, this is the money I have for my Social Security check, you know, to cover me through this week. I ain't giving it to you guys. He offers to exchange insurance, which is something Mike's character normally would do as a rational human being. Obviously, Tuco's not going to do that because, well, Tuco's a criminal. And he's not going to be giving information out like that. He wants cash, and he notices before, as Mike is paying for the food, that Mike has some cash in his wallet. This is all to lure Tuco in. And Tuco, you know, demands wallet. And he's like, you see me sweating, bitch? Wallet. Yeah. And so Mike gives up his wallet. And after saying, I ain't giving you a damn thing, Tuco shows that he has a gun on him. And I love the almost like a Western duel. Like, you see the camera look at Tuco's eye as Mike reaches for his wallet. Tuco thinks he's going to pull a gun on him. At least that's my thinking, unless I'm reading too much into the scene.
He's definitely paranoid, for sure.
He thinks that one might have a gun as well. Mike doesn't, in this scene at least. And, you know, Mike hands over the wallet, and Tuco says, it's like 300, 400 bucks here or whatever. And sure enough, we hear police sirens, and Nacho says it's time to bounce, you know, because now Nacho's probably clued in at this point what Mike has tried to implement here. Nacho drives away. His dealing for the day is done. And, Tuco's still chatting with Mike, and he's like, you know, you've got some balls on you, old man. I can't remember what he says, but... Mike grabs a hold of Tuco, and Tuco's like, what the hell, you know, let go. And Tuco kind of swings around Mike into the post, and Mike grabs onto, like, for support. And he's like, let go. And he starts socking on his face. And he punches him several times with brute force. And Mike doesn't throw any punches back. But he stands up long enough to get the police to arrive on time. They'll spot Tuco's gun at the scene. Because it gets knocked out of Tuco's pocket underneath the car. And our drug cartel king will end up going to jail. And Mike kind of has a little grin. And is, is that all you got?
Not before Tuco gets one last punch in.
He has that laugh and socks him again. It's like almost Tuco's happy. It's almost like he doesn't care that he's been busted. But and here at the end of the episode, Mike meets with Nacho, who's amazed that Mike is still standing. Nacho gives him $25,000. I forgot about that detail. Instead, because Tuco is still alive. And tells Mike, you know, a lot of trouble could have been saved if Mike killed him outright with the gun.
Would have done the world a favor.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about that, you know, in a second here. When the scene in the episode concludes basically with Mike driving off in the dust as Nacho watches with interest. And then, if we look at the sequence of events, the beginning of the episode today is really the real end, because that was it was a flash forward to Mike, trying to patch and treat his eye from the horrible swelling and the damage that had been done from Tuco. And yeah, that's one of the best individual scenes, I think, in this season. And that wraps up today's episode for Order of Events.
It's all there.
Shh. Let the man count.
So next time, huh?
Yes, I would like to report a fight going on at the Il Mexicano restaurant in the 5,000 block of Isleta Boulevard. There is a man threatening another man with a gun. It looks to be some sort of gang thing. Sorry. I'm a passerby. I don't want to get involved.
The fuck? Did you see that?
See what?
That old man just hit my car.
Dude, you're talking to me.
Check out Mr. Magoo here. Yes, sir. You see that car that you parked your piece of shit next to? That's mine. You just ran into it.
You keep the change.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Don't you walk away from me.
Hey, Pops, you better listen to the man.
Come on, guys. Listen. Just keep things friendly, all right?
I ain't your friend. Look, you see that? You did that.
Oh, come on, that'll buff right out.
You're gonna make this all right. You're not leaving until you do.
Fine, you got a pen?
You're not?
I offered to do this the right way. If you can't accept that, then I can't help you. Oh, come on, guys.
I'm gonna make this real simple for you. Give me your wallet, and maybe you walk away from this.
I'm not giving you a damn thing.
Holmes, give me your wallet.
Let's just stay calm here.
You see me sweating, bitch? Wallet. Wallet. You got some crazy lip on you, old man. Your life worth $400.
Hey, Tuco, time to bounce.
Yeah, go. Go. What the hell? Let go. Let go. Let go. Let go. Let go. Let go.
Hands up. Now.
That all you got?
Get on the ground!
To me, it was just a hilarious scene. Mike's nonchalance as he walks through the restaurant while Tuco's like trying to get his attention. Hey!
Hey!
And just the masterful, like, He knows what kind of person from Nacho's description that he's dealing with here, and he knows how to trigger him so well, from the flashing of the cash as he pays the cashier to the taunting it as he whispers in his ear outside. I think he does a great job, and he knows exactly what he's doing, right? And it sort of times it perfectly too with the cops, funny enough.
It's a really interesting scene, and Alex and I were briefly talking about this before we recorded today, but we thought there's still been a lot of discussion as Better Call Saul is gearing up to go into its final season. They're going to have to address how Tuco gets out of jail. And not to spoil things for if you haven't seen the rest of Better Call Saul, but this is the last time, as of now, that we have seen Raymond Cruz portray Tuco. We'll get some references of him later in a couple of the seasons. In fact, the most recent season of Better Call Saul. But it's very interesting how they decided to remove his character from the picture. And as Alex noted earlier, we see in the episode, Nacho knows that Tuco's already doing crystal. That's one of the very first mentions of crystal meth we get in Better Call Saul, basically. It might be the first.
Mm.
And it kind of makes you wonder, where is Tuco getting it from at this point? It could be just bikers or a gang or related. But it definitely has some implications on maybe what the final season's going to bring. And, you know, would it have been a better decision? I guess I'll ask you, Alex. Because I can't ask if they would have killed him, because they can't. But would it have been a better decision by the writers for Mike to try to kill him, and maybe for some reason, it goes wrong?
I think, personally, that would be also just as interesting. But I'm fine with this decision. I think it accurately portrays Mike in this certain instance, and I think I heard from someone else a great statement on the show. It's not just Jimmy's progression as a character, but also other characters' progression.
For sure.
Mike is definitely number two spot on the show.
Oh, yeah.
Probably alongside Kim in their character's development. And Mike, in Better Call, say in Breaking Bad, he would have shot Tuco right away with no hesitation. I think his character is vastly different, and we do get to see him develop in Better Call Saul as well. So at this moment in time, yeah, he has some sympathy. Like, I mean, with everything that happened, last thing he wants is more bloodshed after 5-0 and everything like that, right? Especially when it comes to partners.
Yeah.
But he would definitely change in future, I think.
I've been thinking about that whole scene a lot, because you're putting a character in jail, and a pretty important one down the road. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, you could speculate like what they could have done. Maybe, you know, Mike does go for the sniper rifle option, tries taking a shot, but maybe Nacho gets in the way, or a car goes by and, you know, the bullet doesn't hit. I'm just using my imagination, but they didn't go that route. They figured, okay, let's have Mike take a brutal beating. And then you think, well, Mike's going to have to explain it to his family how he got beaten up, as we see Walt has to a lot in Breaking Bad. It's Mike's daughter-in-law and his granddaughter. I've thought, because 5-0 was so focused on Mike, this episode did a nice job of picking up some of the things that left off. You brought up several points, you know, Mike pretending to get drunk, how he breaks into the cop car and lifts the window to the car, I think, with the string, so that he can place the gun already in the cop car. Mike's a very tactical guy, and this episode shows a bit more of it. His patience, I guess, maybe more so.
Mm. Yeah, his patience and attention to detail, and his thoroughness, for sure. There's also another question I wanted to bring up, and ties into the second scene here. The show does explicitly answer one part of this question, but does Jimmy seem to understand the issue that the partners raised with the commercial, and does he agree with it?
You know, I think he only... I think it starts to weigh on him later, probably after he's talked to Chuck. But I know for the longest time he's thinking he's in the right. And when you're in that frame of mind, it's very hard to see outside of your world around you. Mm. I fall into that as a bad habit sometimes, you know. I think we probably all do in certain things. But no, it's such a gray area, because I understand it now more from your perspective on the show, where he's almost going at the whole thing as a sole practitioner, but he can't. He is a lawyer. He's part of a team. He has to abide by the rules and regulations of working under a law firm. Mm. If he's on his own, he can do that all he wants. You know, the commercial, it was completely legal, you know, but he didn't get that thing cleared. I think, to your question, I think he realizes he did wrong. And then it's also interesting hearing him say to Chuck that he never really wanted the job in the first place.
Mm, that's a great point.
And we'll keep talking about how that potentially snowballs further down in the second season, for those who know what I'm already talking about referencing. But yeah.
And do you think it's unwarranted, Kim's reaction to Jimmy when she's in the basement looking after files?
Do I think it's warranted or
unwarranted?
Unwarranted. Well, you know, I think later in the episode, I guess Chuck describes it better, in that Kim was the one who helped refer to Howard to refer to the firm to hire Jimmy. So when you think about it a little bit more, it is a reflection on Kim. This is the person you told us that should be made potentially into a partner someday. And now he's made us look like fools. So yeah. She does have a right to be upset at Jimmy. She does not deserve to be working in Doc Review, but she does have a right to be upset at Jimmy.
Mm. Yeah. Any further thoughts on the episode?
I think it's a great episode. I think it's one of the best in the season. I am biased because I think Raymond Cruz knocks it out of the park playing Tuco Salamanca. It kind of dying to hopefully he has another cameo some point on the show. But it is interesting, you know, we've gotten a few more Breaking Bad cameos. Now all of a sudden Crazy 8, or well, Domingo was thrown into the picture. The cartel has another hangout where they're doing some side business. And now for Nacho, what's this going to mean? Now his door is going to be completely open. He's going to essentially kind of move up a rank while the other one's in jail.
Mm.
Almost think, at least for now.
There'll definitely be a hole in position of power for a bit.
Yeah.
That's for certain. Personally, I really loved scene 4 as well. As I discussed, whenever both actors are on scene, Jimmy and Chuck.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're both amazing, but I think Chuck's reaction, I love seeing it further in detail the more times I watch it. Just his feigned indifference. He tries to play off as if he's above Jimmy at points, as if he's not emotional, mm-hmm. as if he's more logical. But clearly, as we can see with his condition, has an effect on him, whether he likes it or not. And it's more just a play, if anything. So, yeah. It's a great episode overall.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed it.
Listen, guys, we're really happy to be back recording this live from Winnipeg, Manitoba, you know, on a very warm August afternoon, August evening, rather. We've had quite the heat wave this summer here in most of Western Canada, and we're happy to be bringing you back. Hopefully, we'll be doing this more on a weekly basis now, and we'll definitely got to get through the rest of season 2. Our podcast is still up and running. It's available on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Google Podcasts, lots of ways for you to check out our show. We really appreciate the support. We know we've been hearing a lot of support from different states across the U.S., a lot of people tuning in from there, different parts of Canada, parts of Europe. We really appreciate it, guys. And yeah, Rebecca is the next episode on tap. We'll be reaching the midpoint of season 2, so things will be interesting. And the title is an interesting one, too.
Can't wait for you to join us on episode 5.
Yeah.
See you guys soon.
Take care, guys. It's great to be back recording again, folks, and thank you very much for tuning in. As usual, our show's theme is The House, recorded by Adrian Behringer, and music featured in tonight's show was No Light Without Darkness by Ketza, Spare Change by Lance Winner Conrad, Why by Emmanuel D'Antoni, Excavate by Marshall Usinger, and our closing credits theme, Lonely Dusty Trail by Jonathan Mogavero. Alex and I will be back soon with more episodes discussing Season 2 and more. We can't wait to bring that content to y'all, and we'll catch y'all on the flip side. The Truth Is How You Look At It is a Bernanke and Krause production.